Tonight, though, I'm happy to have returning to our store David Rico. He is the author of many books. I think I have at least one copy of all of his books. I may have missed one. And there's an upcoming one, too. He does. Author, good friend, patron of Many Rivers Books and Tea. And today he will be talking about his latest book, Everyday Commitments, Choosing a Life of Love, Realism, and Acceptance. Thank you very much.
Good evening, everybody, and thanks for coming. And thanks to Jim and Rob and Stuart for inviting me. There's a saying in Alcoholics Anonymous, getting specific is getting well. And I started writing this little book in 1998, trying to figure out how to get specific about two goals in my life. One is to be a person of integrity, and the other is to be a person who shows loving kindness. And I came up with these 52 ways of putting this into practice, and that's my book, Everyday Commitments. So I think I'll just begin with a short reading of a paragraph. The commitments and exercises offered in this book are not strategies by which we seek to gain perfection or happiness in the conventional sense of those words. The purpose of the commitments is to help us live our lives at a heart level. Our destiny is to display in our lifetime the timeless design of love and wholeness that has always been inside of us. Choices and attitudes that show integrity and loving kindness help us do that. They locate and display the intrinsic basic goodness we all possess, which was referred to by the Buddha and many other spiritual teachers. That you've heard the expression, well, everybody has goodness inside. And what I'm proposing is that you bring this goodness out by building up habits of integrity and loving kindness, so that you no longer have to think, should I do this honestly or not? You just automatically do it that way. And Seneca, who is a Roman philosopher of the Stoic school, says, after having done this kind of practice, my goodness now requires no thought, but has become a habit. I cannot but act rightly. So you can actually get to that point. St. Augustine mentions it. When you love, you can do what you will. If you really trust that you're a loving person, then you can look at the things you do and say, oh, I guess that's what love is about, because here I am doing it. Obviously, you could get into a little trouble with this approach, but I'm just trusting that as you build these habits, which you'll hear about some of them, you just notice that you like yourself more. That's what I noticed about these. So you're not doing this to become perfect. And as I say in here, you're not doing them in order to win friends and influence people. I mean, it would be of the nature of integrity that you act in accord with certain principles that you've established, whether or not it gets you anywhere, and whether or not other people act the same way towards you. The commitments that follow may be inspiring, but also intimidating. Very few of us can achieve all these ideals to the fullest. Nonetheless, we can set our bar high and then make some strides and perhaps some leaps. Any advance frees us from fear-based living in favor of healthy love for ourselves and others. I guess I was thinking of that phrase from the Bhagavad Gita. Even a little progress is complete freedom from fear. Even when you notice that, look, I made a little progress in acting with some assertiveness, with some strength, with some more love, with more integrity. That realization frees you from fear, and then you start to realize that the fear all along was based in shame about yourself. And you're not going to be ashamed of yourself when you notice that you're really making an effort to act in ways that show love more directly. So that brings us to this specific one. Number 5, I am not perfect, but I am sincerely committed to working on myself. And as long as I can say that, I can redefine the nature of success. Success is not getting it right all the time, being Olympic perfect. Success is simply, I'm sincerely committed to working on myself, and I'm approximating goodness more and more. I'm never going to be perfect at it, but I'm approximating it better and better. Now, another feature of this book and of my purpose is that this set of 52 commitments could be made within a relationship between two people. So you can say to your partner, unless you don't think this is true, I'm not perfect. Maybe you'll say, you're not perfect, but I am. I'm not perfect, but I am sincerely committed to working on myself. Is that good enough for you? Follow what I mean? And that goes with every one of them in here. Or you could even go one step further if you're not in a relationship and use these as your criteria. Instead of he's got lots of money in the bank, or she's really beautiful, is he sincerely committed to working on himself? Imagine making that one of your criteria. Imagine if you had made that your criteria way back. That's the problem. We made all the big decisions in life before we even knew which questions to ask. I'm becoming more willing to express my feelings and to receive those of others, including fear, joy, grief, and tenderness. I'm practicing ways to show anger nonviolently in ways that are not abusive, threatening, blaming, or out of control. So part of acting with love is learning to express your feelings in ways that do not hurt others. It doesn't mean you wouldn't be angry. It's totally appropriate. Anger is described in the dictionary as displeasure at injustice. And obviously we're going to meet up with injustice and unfairness all the time. So it's appropriate to be angry every day. All you have to do is turn on the radio. But you're looking for ways to show that anger in way that nonviolently, not in abusive, threatening, blaming, or out of control styles. Maybe that's how we saw it in childhood from our parents toward us. That would have made anger very scary. But instead, and so now we might fear showing anger. Maybe people won't like us if we show anger. One of the other commitments in here is that that will matter less and less, other people's reactions. And as I go along, if you have questions, just raise your hand. I forego taking advantage of anyone because of his ignorance, status, or financial straits. I forego the chance to use any charms of word, body, or mind to seduce or trick anyone. Imagine giving that up. I don't want to trick anybody. I want to have them see me just as I am. I don't want to come across as if I can be relied upon as always there. I want them to notice that sometimes I don't come through. And I'm working on that, but I don't want to trick anybody into thinking I'm more than I am, better than I am, more present than I am, more loving than I am. I try my best to keep my word, to honor my commitments, to follow through on the tasks I agree to do. Accepting my own limitations helps me set sane limits and boundaries with others. I no longer make promises for the sake of pleasing or appeasing them. If you would look for ways to establish your boundaries and make it clear to others that there's a limit to what you can give. And I'm seeing that as part of being loving, because it's truthful, rather than the old definition of love, give and give and give until it hurts. This is give in such a way that you don't hurt others or yourself. Does it sound selfish? Good. This is a very advanced group, I know. I am making sincere attempts to abide by standards of rigorous honesty and truthfulness in all my dealings, no matter how others act toward me. My question is not, what can I get away with? But what is the right thing to do? If I fall down in this, I can admit it, make amends, and resolve to act differently next time. Now I more easily and willingly apologize when necessary. I see this a lot with clients, couples. One person just can't apologize. The ego won't permit it. I can't be wrong. So this would be, learning to apologize would be a way of learning to love. When apology is backed up by amends and the resolution to do it differently next time. I examine my conscience regularly, checking in with ourselves. Now let's see, when I did that, where do I stand with that? I am taking an inventory, not only about how I may have hurt others, but also how I may not have activated and shared my gifts, how I may still be holding on to prejudices or the will to retaliate, how I may still not be as loving as I can be. Follow how it works. This is different from a set of commandments. These are affirmations that help you find out what it means to be more gentle toward others. Question?
It seems that there might be a conflict, possible conflict, between two of these. I'm not sure if I've heard both, but let's say at least one of them would say, I will keep my commitments, I will apologize, and with maybe something like, I will accept myself. It seems like, in other words, I think this is what you're saying anyway, just maybe for clarification. It might be where, let's say, someone, a partner, says something to you, you need to apologize, but you can't. You know, it's just like something you can't do, mm-hmm. and you kind of like want to make yourself do it, but you go like, I can't do it now, but... And you accept that, and maybe 24 hours later, or after you've walked around the block, you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
It may take a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I think an important part of this, one of the ones I didn't read, was about honoring your timing and other people's timing. Like, you may not be able to jump into these right away. Well, they're 52 for 52 weeks, so it's supposed to take a whole year. So you can spread it out that way. But thank you for your comment. As I struggle with regret because of the mistakes I made in life, I'm no longer ashamed of my fallibility. I'm more kind toward myself. I take my errors as learning experiences so I can do better in the future. I make amends wherever I can, but my mistakes are becoming my passport to humility and to tender compassion toward myself and others. Imagine looking at your mistakes that way. How can this mistake help me be more compassionate toward myself, rather than I hate myself for having done that? Regret comes from two words that mean to grieve over and over again. And it's like a type of grieving where you're just spinning your wheels instead of really working it through. Now, does this mean you'll just be able to end regret? No, but let's say you took this, and let's say this is one of your problems. It is for me. I keep having regrets about certain things. You know, when I brought up my son, maybe I should have been more of this kind of a dad, or didn't do that. But if I take this and I write it out and put it on the refrigerator and look at it over and over, as I struggle with regret because of the mistakes I made, I'm no longer ashamed. When you keep seeing this over and over, you gradually bring it into yourself and it starts to go from an aspiration to an affirmation. That's the principle of this. I'm letting go of the need to keep up appearances or to project an impressive self-image. I notice that I'm more willing to appear as I am, without pretense, and no matter how unflattering. As I settle into the reality of who I am, with pride in my gifts and awareness of my limits, I notice I more easily access happiness, sanity, and wisdom. Instead of always want to look good. Now here's the one that I mentioned before that I would get to. I notice that my behavior and choices no longer have to be quite so determined by what others may think of me. Better not do this because they'll think this of me. I'm giving up any attempts to get others to accept or love me. I do not change myself in order to fit in anymore. I'm intent on portraying myself as I am, no matter what the reaction. In other words, the success at being who I am becomes more valuable than whether others will like me. That's a growth in integrity. Because your value system has changed. It used to be so important that other people would like me, so I better look my best and do my best. Now it's, did I come across as I really am? Okay. Then that's success. Now listen to this quote by no less a person than Abraham Lincoln. I desire so to conduct the affairs of this administration that if, at the end, when I come to lay down the reins of power, I have lost every friend on earth, I shall at least have one friend left, and that friend shall be deep down inside me. Very touching, isn't it? Now we go a step further even. More and more, Not only do I want to appear as I am, but I even take one more step. More and more, I blow the whistle on myself when I notice myself being phony, untruthful, manipulative, passive-aggressive. I want to come clean right then and there by admitting that I'm acting falsely. Wait a minute, when I did that, I was being passive-aggressive. I want to admit it. These are the ways I'm choosing to be more authentic in my relationships. Do we want this kind of authenticity? Does this seem appealing? Any answers? Okay.
I guess we have to own up to it at some point.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's owning up to who you are. But wouldn't you like this type of a partner?
Yeah, what if you don't have that kind of a partner and you want to become that?
Give him this book and say, get to work. Yes?
Well, you know, it seems very appealing, and yet the whole world has to come along.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's the work on me. This is about the work that I can do with me, and yet authenticity, the lack of appreciation, the resistance, the projection on what people assume rather than what is authentic is so hard to bear.
I agree.
It's really hard to bear.
It is, and you feel kind of isolated.
Yeah.
That goes with the territory. You would have to get to the place of, well, I want to work on myself, and these are my standards, and whether or not the whole world is with me, it no longer matters, because I've become so excited by the prospect of being a person of love and integrity that it no longer matters whether they come along. I mean, that's what he meant by, I desire so to conduct the affairs of the administration, that if at the end nobody else came along, like let's say nobody was against slavery but me, I would still be against it. That you'd have to at least have come to that point. If we're going to wait until everybody else acts in a loving way, we may never find out all the love we have inside us. What else could the purpose of life be than to take the unique way of loving that we have and finally show it in every way we can? The founder of Methodist religion, John Wesley, has a lovely prayer. I think I have it in here, actually. Something about, I want to do all the good I can in every way I can, everywhere I can, to every person I meet for as long as I ever shall live. Something like that. That would be the idea. And it's all, I want to do this rather than I'll wait until other people get the same message or do it with me. But I agree with what you're saying.
I feel like when you said earlier, does this sound selfish? It's that the pain of being viewed as selfish when so deeply reflecting not to be selfish and to be coming from loving kindness and be judged as selfish for boundaries and for self-care and things like that.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I've been doing this work. And I can truthfully say, and not to toot my own horn or anything, but just to show that it can be done, when people misunderstand me, I say to myself, well, did I do something wrong here, or am I simply being misunderstood? If I am being misunderstood, I can just allow that. I don't have to go and correct the impression anymore, like I used to. Oh, I didn't mean that, I meant this. I just figure, well, if they want to bring it up, fine, but, you know, I think I did the best I could, and I know I didn't act out of malice, and so I can let that be okay. You'll find yourself much less stressed.
I'd like to add something to what you said, and especially in response. Someone told me years ago something that's always stuck with me. It was that when you no longer care whether people like you, they will.
Well, they'll respect you more for being no longer at the mercy of other people's opinions. Question? Yeah.
This is a tough one for me. Following on this question of someone misunderstanding you or perceiving you wrong, let's say for me, as it has been, I want to explain myself, out of my own ego need. I want to be seen as just and all this. But what if there's another aspect to it? I'm not denying that I have that, my side of it. But what if you see that it really pains the other person, because they go, well, but I thought I had a loving dad, or I thought I had a loving partner, or something, and they're really pained, and you want to set it right so that they won't be pained, so they can go, oh, I see, okay, my heart feels better. Do you know where I'm going with that?
Yeah, so that would be an example of where you would speak up.
Yeah, okay.
If it's only to make yourself look good,
right.
Then it doesn't matter, but if it is somehow helpful, then you would.
It's not like, well, I don't care, I'm doing it.
Oh, no.
Right. Okay.
No, it's not, and I don't care. It's more of, we're doing a different thing now from what we used to do. When someone upsets me and it keeps gnawing at me, he was curt toward me, or he was whatever, keeps bothering me, sticking in my craw, I do not attribute it only to the person and what he did. I take my reaction as a signal that something has been triggered in me, and that makes me look at myself rather than blame the other. And I have three questions that I ask when that happens. Is this my own shadow? In other words, am I the same way, but he's getting away with it? Am I just as curt or controlling as he is, but he gets away with it and I don't? Is this my big fat ego? How dare he treat me like that? Doesn't he realize I'm a big shot? Or I'll show him he's not going to get away with this. That's all ego. Love's greatest enemy. And third, is it my early life? That's how my dad talked to me. That's why I'm mad. See, you ask yourself these kind of questions, it makes it part of your work rather than the way the other person is. So you get something out of it. I do not knowingly hurt others. If others hurt me, I do not have to retaliate or punish them. Instead, I open a dialogue and ask for amends. No matter what, I do not hate anyone or hold grudges. A healthy person would never hate. The reason you wouldn't hate is because hate is rage with an insatiable need to keep getting revenge and never be satisfied. No healthy person would be like that. Get it out, get it over with, and drop it. Some people feel ongoing hate, which is a sad and dangerous condition to be possessed by. As we become more spiritually evolved, we may feel moments of hate, but we vow not to act on them, and gradually they and all the stresses in their wake subside. I never give up on others. This is based on the Buddhist principle that you never give up on others because of their inherent goodness. I believe that everyone has an innate goodness and that being loved can release it. So this is not giving up in despair on the ultimate goodness of others, no matter how they behave. You still believe that they have an inherent, ineradicable goodness. Then we can trust that our love, even from afar, will help bring it out into the open. This is the loving faith in humanity, the one that releases more love into the world. Some faith may seem like superstition or wishful thinking. Yet faith in Buddha nature, Christ consciousness, or the inner light of every human being is an affirmation that we really do believe in the wonderful potential of humanity. I am becoming more able to say ouch to pain in jobs, relationships, and in my interactions with others. I want to take action to change what can be changed and to move on when a situation remains abusive. I do this without self-pity or the need to make others wrong. When I stand up for my rights, I do not gloat if I'm vindicated, nor do I seek revenge if I'm not. Does that sound like an appealing way to be?
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that in some groups, there are people who are continually put down or excluded. We've all had that experience. Like at work, they're always talking about a certain person, and she's kind of an outsider. Rather than be comforted that I am still an insider, so I'd be giving up that kind of comfort, I sense the pain of those who are our outsiders. I can reach out, speak up, and include them in my circle of love. This has a lot to do with gossip. The reason gossip is so enjoyable is because you feel like an insider, because you've made somebody else the outsider, the one you're talking about. So you would be looking into that, and you would be no longer engaging in it. This little poem by Edwin Markham fits. He drew a circle to shut me out. Heretic, rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle and brought them in. So you'd be operating that way. Now here's an interesting one, because we don't often think about the distinction in humor between positive and negative. I have a sense of humor, but not at the expense of others. I am less and less apt to engage in ridicule, teasing, sarcasm, or the use of comebacks when others are sarcastic toward me. In other words, I would no longer see sarcasm as humor. Why? Because I lifted the skirt of the sarcasm, which is humorous, and saw the pain underneath. I seek simply to feel the pain in both of us and to look for ways to bring more mutual respect into our communication. Sarcasm in Greek means to cut flesh. They noticed that sarcasm was negative. So it has no place in the repertory of a truly healthy person. So even your way of showing humor would change. You'd be more like Bob Hope than Don Rickles. I am focusing on becoming consistent, being the same kind of person at home, at work, in my friendships, and in my day-to-day dealings. I'm showing equal respect and sincerity towards strangers as I show toward those close to me, and vice versa. Now that is an interesting challenge, isn't it? Because we usually have a whole different way of operating with different people. Questions about this?
Yeah.
so far? I can now measure my success by how much steadfast love I have, not by how much money I have in the bank, how much I achieve in business, or how much power I have over others. Expressing my full and unique capacity to love is becoming the central focus of my life.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. You said you measure the success by how much steadfast love you have. What does that mean, the love you have?
How much love I have inside me that I'm steadfast in showing has become more the way I judge myself rather than how rich I am, how much I've achieved in business. In other words, it's change in your values. Our values become more spiritually sound as we focus on showing love rather than on gaining control.
I've got a general question. When you wrote this, how did you envision this book would be used by people? Because to me, these are pretty monumental changes you could go through. And you just don't sit down and read it.
No, you'd have to work. It's like more of a workbook. Yeah, you have to work on it. Well, where I got them is from the people I admire. I just kept noting down all the qualities of people that I admire. And I came up with these. And as far as what I intended it as a book of practices rather than book of information. It's not like my other books, which are more information and some practices, but this is all practices. Hence the title, Commitment. I mean, it would be, this is a lifestyle that you would make a commitment to. And I guarantee you, you like yourself more when you're like this. It's not like you're doing this because you'll be more successful. It's not that kind of a promise. The only promise in this is you'll have more integrity and you'll show more love. Yeah, go ahead.
How do you use it?
I use it exactly that way.
So like,
I keep coming back. I know them by heart, so I don't have to read.
Yeah, I know, but even
I think every time something happens, my mind goes to one of these. Because I've worked on them so long, I just know them. Well, this is one you'll find enjoyable. I am less and less under the blinding influence of the three main streets that direct so many attitudes and lifestyles. Madison Avenue, Wall Street, and Hollywood Boulevard. I'm no longer walking those three streets. I have a funny way of putting it. Moving away from these three streets, we choose instead to stand on the corner of mindfulness and loving kindness. There we are dressed as we choose, not compelled to sport the latest fashion unless we genuinely like it. From that corner, we love sanely and we can see everyone else without envy. We arrived there on foot, or driving the vehicle that serves our needs rather than the one that makes the best impression. There are no movies there, only the moving reality of who we are in all our contented ordinariness. Isn't that a wonderful goal to have? Contented ordinariness is the opposite of the Hollywood Boulevard. I'm learning not to be swayed by opportunities for quick gain, by sweet talk or rhetoric, or by any other seductions that might lead me to transgress my boundaries or to act foolishly. I cherish the joy of a good conscience more than what I may gain or get away with.
Okay.
I have reason to be proud of some of my accomplishments, Thoreau wrote in his journal. A man looks with pride at his woodpile. I see my commitments to integrity and love as my woodpile. Woodpile, you know, you have to cut all the 4x4 to fit in the fireplace. And you stack them. And you look at them and say, wow, I did that. Questions? Now, here's an interesting set of questions to ask yourself going into a relationship or being in one. Am I happy here? See, these are the kind of questions that would come up. Do I feel threatened, scared, or disrespected? Am I accepted as I am? Am I encouraged to act in accord with my own deepest needs and wishes? Do I feel the five A's coming my way? Attention, acceptance, appreciation, affection, and allowing. Am I a partner and a team player? Or do I or my partner insist on dominating? Am I activating my unique potential of love here? Am I open to others' love for me? These are the kind of questions you would ask in a relationship. I'm willing to work hard to fulfill my life purpose, but not to sacrifice my health by seeking to please others or gain status, fame, or fortune, the central values of the chronically uneasy ego. The primary focus of my life has become being a good person. And I quote James Fox. He's the abbot of the Trappist Monastery in Gethsemane, where Thomas Merton was a monk. And he said this at the 25th reunion of his Harvard Business School to his classmates. I found myself asking, is this what life is for? To burn it up in sweating, steaming, and toiling in a race for power, prestige, passion, pleasure, and piles of stocks and bonds, from every one of which I am going to be separated someday? Is this what it's about? So the alternative would be my primary focus in life has become being a good person. Sort of a description of sanctity, isn't it? That word in Latin means wholeness. In other words, it includes your psychological health and your spiritual progress. And in keeping with this job and career subject, I am choosing not to push others aside so that I can get ahead. I choose neither to exalt myself nor to abase myself. Instead, I take my turn without complaint at being first, last, or midway in the long series of lineups that life has in store for all of us. Is it okay with me that I'm last this time? Is it okay with me that I'm in the middle? Or do I have to push everybody aside to get to the front of the line? Questions coming up about any of these? More and more, my sexuality expresses love, joyful playfulness, and responsibility. I'm letting go of any guilt and phobia from childhood in favor of an adult style of relating and enjoying. And then I give Thomas Merton's definition of purity. It is the spirit of celebration, gratitude, and joy in your body and in your sexuality. It's not quite what they taught us in catechism. We explore the places in our sexuality that may still be held hostage by puritanical beliefs meant to scare rather than liberate us. Then I give this great quote by William Blake, the great mystic poet of the West. The Lamb of God sports in the garden of sexual delight. You know, Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. Where will you find him? He's in the garden of sexual delight. I'm learning to keep better tabs on my use of food, alcohol, drugs, sex, gambling, and shopping, knowing they can be vehicles of addiction. I'm always looking for ways to show moderation without inhibition. That would be the goal.
Can you give some example? I'm having a little trouble getting my mind around that one. How do you show moderation without including inhibition?
Because you're still enjoying rather than inhibiting yourself from enjoyable things, but you're doing it in a way that doesn't lead you to addiction or
so what compulsion. I'm trying to work back from the motivation, and the motivation is to show moderation. Is that right?
Motivation would be your health. If you trace it back, your motivation would be, in order to maintain my health of mind and body, I don't want to get addicted to food, drugs, alcohol, so forth. Mm-hmm. But I still want to enjoy them. So I'm looking for a way to enjoy them moderately rather than X them out. Mm-hmm. But I'm always keeping tabs that I don't go too far. I kept wondering what my brother was up to in L.A. because I called down there on the weekend, he's not there. So one day I called, it was a Saturday, and a friend of his answered who was staying at his house. I said, is Kenny there? No, Kenny's not here. I said, well, do you know when he'll be back? Gee, I don't know if he went to Vegas this weekend. All of a sudden it became clear. I said, oh, I mean, I didn't know anything about this. I don't know if he went to Vegas this weekend. In other words, he goes every weekend. So that would be getting caught up in something that could be fun, but it could harm you if you overdo it. Other people have questions on that one? I'm aware of the pain and poverty of those less fortunate than myself. Confronted with the suffering in the world, I do not turn my eyes away, nor do I get stuck in blaming God or humanity, but simply ask, what then shall I do? I keep finding ways to respond with time, attention, money, and myself, no matter how minimal. It is better to light one candle than to curse the darkness. Here's where I say it's not enough to feel compassion, but we do best to show it in action. And this is an interesting point having to do with calling. Not all of us are called to leave our life routine or our daily responsibilities to go to faraway places as aid workers. We are not less valuable to the world because we stay at home and make a donation or write our congressman. The point is to let our compassion and concern activate us in the great compassion, which is a Buddhist phrase. Our caring about suffering means a commitment to relieve it. May you be free of suffering, then becomes, I commit myself to help that happen. And the challenge will be to find the form of implementation that fits for you. So that's where you would ask, what is my calling? Not everybody's called to join the Peace Corps. So you're not looking down on yourself because you didn't go protest and wind up in jail, because that's not your calling. But everybody's calling is to make some contribution. My work on myself is making me more conscious of political issues in today's world. I'm learning to question authority. I'm looking for ways to work for an end to war, retaliation, greed, hate, and ignorance. I have not given up on believing in the possibility of transformation of the world and of every political and religious leader. I'm still believing that they can be changed. You know, when I used to see George Bush on TV, my first thought was, what a jerk. And then I thought, no, this does not fit with the path, the Buddhist path. So I made a decision. Every time I see him on the television, and I've kept my promise, instead of saying, he's a jerk, he's a puppet of big corporations, any of that, I say, may you be converted to Buddhism. May you become a pioneer of peace. Why not? Why not say that instead of, may you are a jerk? This changes the relationship between me and him. So that, and it shows that I'm really believing in the basic human goodness and the potential for transformation. Because he could change, just as we have. My love of nature makes me tread gently on the earth with what St. Bonaventure called a courtesy toward natural things. So this is where your love of nature would become part of your spiritual practice. And by the way, after each one of these things I'm reading, I have a specific practice of how to implement it. That's the point of this. I admire certain people, alive or dead, who represent the ideals I cherish. I see them not as idols, but as models of what I can accomplish. They are mirrors of my own potential. So when you look at a statue of Buddha or of a saint, don't think of it as a image that you're venerating. Think of it as a mirror of what you look like inside. I look like St. Francis talking to the birds. I look like Buddha sitting there mindfully. I look like St. Therese scattering roses. That's what's in me. So that's a mirror of me. I see my own love and wisdom as gifts, spiritual energies that do not come from me, but act through me. I say thanks for these encouraging graces and yes to the stirring call to keep living up to them. So this is where I'm trying to point out that whatever we do achieve, it's a grace that comes through us. It's not something that we've accomplished. So this is not a collection of accomplishments even, except for the woodpile. Everything is a grace. And my final one is, though I am not always successful in virtuous living or upholding these commitments, they are the ideals I'm shooting for, and I place my intention to live this way. The human heart is surely a most precious and mysterious reality. It can be strong, yet it can be hurt. It can be open, yet it can close. It can include others in love, yet it can exclude others because of fear. These polarities need not discourage us. They point us to our splendid evolutionary task. We are here to go beyond fear and limitation so that we can become ever more open to love. Indeed, we were given a lifetime just for that. Any other final questions about any of these or the whole idea?
Just a comment. I had a question going through my mind as you were reading this about humility. You know, what would keep a person who is doing this humble, or you know, not self-righteous, or you know, feeling like they want to do everything right? But the second to the last about grace. That would keep a person humble no matter how excellently they could do every one of these.
Yes.
Is to realize it's not coming from me. Mm-hmm. So that answered that question.
Yes.
I appreciate that.
Very, very good point. You've all seen the Pope up in the balcony with all the people in St. Peter's Square cheering him. And a common hand motion that he uses is this. We've all seen that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But most people don't know what it means. It means all that honor that you're giving me, don't give it to me. Send it up there. Mm-hmm. Send it up to God. Mm-hmm. That's what that means. Isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I hope the Pope knows that's what it means. Yeah, you would see it as you would see any success as a grace, and so you would have thanks, further building your humility, which is what it would take to do some of these things. It's humble to keep being nice to people when they're not nice to you. Are you going to say something?
It's interesting. I wasn't going to, but I just remember working with someone years ago in the Middle East, Hassan, and I just remember him always saying, Alhamdulillah, which is by the grace of, I mean, the way I interpret it was by the grace of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not as if you have to believe that there's a God up in heaven looking down on you. You could see it as the Buddhist approach is the inherent goodness, the Buddha nature that we all have. You can see it that way. You don't have to see it as in a dualistic way. Yes?
The comment you just made about like when somebody is being humble, when somebody is taking advantage of you, I had experience recently where I sort of I either could choose to think this person is screwing me over, taking advantage, running over me, manipulating me, et cetera, or I'm going to generously give him, which is what is really not his due, and be bigger than him, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I have both interpretations of the experience in my head, even as I speak, after resolving the situation, essentially giving him what he wanted on the threat of a lawsuit, etc. But the situation is, it's really not his issue. It's in me how I deal with that. The thing of egotistically, you know, I'm being taken advantage of, or I'm going to be the bigger person, magnanimous in this, and give this as somehow as a gift and be bigger than him, even when I'm just lying, cheating, whatever. Can you speak to those situations in life that many of us have in this modern day of dog-eat-dog, bringing the values of maybe it's Buddhist compassion or generosity into it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say...
Where there isn't fair and reason with a person who you would hope you could deal with fair and reason both ways, and it's not coming from.
Remember, one of them was, you know, I say ouch. Like, you could say ouch. You could say it hurts to be treated like this. You could work for justice so that things come out fairly. And when you see that you've done all you can and it's still not going to work, then you can find a way to bring it to an end generously and without retaliation. That would be the style. We have to be careful of expressions like, I'll be bigger than him. We have to say, how do I open my heart in this instance? Trungpa Rinpoche, who's a Tibetan Buddhist teacher, my teacher, says, a relationship will never work if both people are absolutely fair. One of them has to be generous. So that's the opportunity that you're being given in that instance. Kind of fits with the Sermon on the Mount.
This notion of, well, I'll be reasonable and fair if I get it mutually back enough. And that is what I'm speaking to, I think.
Yeah. There wouldn't be any if. It's always, I'll be reasonable and fair, and then at other times I'll be generous and I'll say ouch when someone else is unfair, but I won't let their way of doing things dictate my response, because I come from a standard. Good way to know what a standard is, very simple. Let's say you're renting an apartment. You could have approach number one, which is, if they complain about the plumbing, which doesn't work that well, I'll fix it. That's one approach. The other approach is, I've looked at the plumbing, it doesn't work that well, and I won't rent a place with plumbing like this. I believe the plumbing has to be done right. That's the standard I operate out of. I'm not going to wait for them to call. I'm going to do it now before I even rent it to them. The second guy, that's this. He operates out of a standard. Doesn't matter whether they call or notice it, because I don't rent places like when the toilet doesn't work right. It's just not who I am. Whereas another guy will say, I'll wait for them to call. Maybe they'll just live with it. Maybe they'll fix it themselves. See, that's a different way of being. That doesn't come from integrity. It comes from, what can I get away with? One of the things I mentioned in here. But there are people like that. And then the third type of person is, they can call all they want, I don't intend to fix it. That's even one step lower on the totem pole. I have my little... I've noticed whenever I recommend to clients who are obviously alcoholics, that they go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And of course, they go to one meeting and then they say, I don't want to go back. It's too religious. Those people have too many more problems than I have. I'm not like those people. There were too many prayers. But I know why they won't go back. It's as simple as can be. I have it right here. At the end of the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, they all hold hands and they say, keep coming back. It really works. That's why they don't want to go back. Because it really works. Well, I'm not coming back here. This is going to get in the way of my drinking. That's the only reason I'm not going to. It has nothing to do with prayers and God. I mean, if you want to change, you'll put up with anything. So I have in here, we won't keep going back. We won't want to keep going back to Alcoholics Anonymous because it really works. That's why you don't want to go back, because it really works. That is the challenge that takes true perseverance and openness to the grace that wants us to be whole. I was just using it as an example in the section about alcohol. Any other final questions before we wind up? Okay, yeah?
You've really put in words so many things that I've been trying in my life to find. And I really appreciate that. And one of the things that I've struggled with, though, that I've had, is the sense of am I really right, or is that, am I coming from that true place? And I grew up in a Christian religion and have really moved away from that because I wasn't comfortable with the belief, the system of belief and faith. Could you talk a little bit about belief and faith? You mentioned a little bit about that.
Faith
and belief. And that maybe the difference between those and the place of those in our lives.
Well, you're believing in something. Well, let me use the distinction that St. Thomas Aquinas used and Cardinal Newman, that there are two kinds of belief. There's the belief that's in your head, which they called notional belief. For instance, I believe that there's a God and that God is love. So that's a notional belief. It's all in here. And then real belief, and that word real in Latin means thing. So it shows itself in things. It shows itself in the way you act. Real belief would be, well, if God is love, and I'm made in the image of God, then my purpose in life is to act in a loving way. So I go out and I act lovingly. That's having faith. The other person, who just believed it in here, oh, well, God is love, and we're all made in the image of God, and that's it. Now I just go about doing all my usual things. Only has notional belief rather than real belief. Notional faith rather than real faith. Everybody follow? So if you recite the Apostles' Creed or any creed, I believe in God the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth, so forth, those are only statements in your mind. You would have to find a way to put every one of those into practice if you had real faith. It's pretty hard because nobody even mentions this. But thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you.
Any other comments or ideas? Well, thank you very much for the lovely attention and sharing. And
thank you, David. It's delightful to have you here again.
You're welcome.
And thank you.